I'll do a really quick introduction. My name is Mems, I'm part of the Open Education team. Thank you for coming. This itself is going to be really, really fun. We have Jennifer Hamilton with her and Peter Ratcliffe, and they'll be presenting. But this is a really, really interesting discussion because of attainment within African and Caribbean children in particular. Hopefully you'll be able to learn like many of the reasons why. It's for me, especially neoliberalism and the ways of assessments play a very interesting part in this. And as regards to higher education, looking at how well African and Caribbean students do whilst at school compared to how they do in university is very, very interesting. So yeah, if you have any questions, please do raise up your hand and I'm sure they'll be very happy to help. And if you'd like to get involved with Open Education series, please speak to me or Melissa or anybody else. So thank you and enjoy yourself.
Okay, good evening. I'm Dennis Alton, this is Peter Rapid. Thank you all for coming. Probably do some housekeeping now, but I don't know where the toilets are. Ah, there they are, out there, so you all know where they are. We are going to do a short talk today about the education of African Caribbean children. The problem, as we see it, of neoliberalism, particularly with the idea of the equality agenda and how that might be a problem for the attainment of African Caribbean children. Now, when we're talking about neoliberalism, we are specifically talking about this way of organizing capitalism. And the aspects that we're looking at is particularly this idea of the belief in free markets and the reduction of the role of the state in society. So you've got this idea of a small state and the idea of unregulated free markets. Now, we're going to do this in kind of two bits, whereas Peter is first of all going to talk about the equality agenda and the role of government, and particularly the legislative changes which relates to race equality. And then I am going to put it in a more specific context in terms of the education of African Caribbean children, where racial disadvantage in the education sector is concerned. Now, Peter's going to cover the changes in the equality agenda, looking at the 1965 Race Relations Act, changes in the Act from 1968, then on to 1976 and the Commission for Racial Equality, and also the 2000 amendment of the Race Relations Act. We'll then look at ideas of the Education Reform Act and how they actually brought in the ideas of neoliberalism, the McPherson Report, and finally the Equality Agenda. That's a kind of macro context. I'm looking more specifically at these types of changes, changes in ideology. Now, these changes are endogenous in terms of one shift in political and ideological thinking starts within another. So we're looking at starting from the 1960s and assimilation, going on to multicultural education, anti-racist education, marketization, the third way ideology of New Labour, and then finally ending up with where we are today, the idea of neoliberalism, which is being pushed through under the pretext of austerity. I shall end by really summing up why racial equality matters to everyone. It's not just a matter of why it matters to black people, why it matters to me, but why it actually matters to everyone. Okay. Now, Peter is going to take over and he'll do his bit, I'll do my bit, and then you can ask some questions. Okay, so let's do this.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, thanks. Well, I'm going to take a similar timeline to Dennis. So basically, we're going to go along parallel lines, and I'm going to try to make some links with what Dennis is going to say. Essentially, I guess the theme of what I'm going to talk about is the relationship between neoliberalism and the equality agenda, the very problematic relationship between neoliberalism and the whole idea of promoting equality. You'll see just how problematic that relationship is soon. Essentially, what I'm going to try and cover is these basic areas. Essentially, the way that equality legislation emerges, it doesn't simply happen. People don't suddenly sit in government and say, it's about time we had a piece of legislation on race equality. It actually comes about through a social process, through social agency. In America, we saw the civil rights movement and so on. We've seen here a whole number of agents, if you like, that have come together to generate the equality legislation. So I'm going to say a bit more about that. Then about effectively the beginning of anti-discrimination legislation through the 1960s and 1970s. And then, in a sense, illustrating this problematic relationship between neoliberalism and equality, we'll see the retrenchment, in other words, the effectively the reaction against the equality agenda that actually occurred through the Thatcher Major years. And I'll say a little bit about its impact on the education sector, which will provide a sort of link with what Dennis is talking about. And then I'm actually going to talk again as we come closer to the present day about the idea of a move to generic equality policies, move away from a focus on particular realms of equality like race and gender to a more generic approach. And even possibly a move to what might be seen as being a post-race social agenda, which clearly has many concerns for us. And contextualising that within the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Now, what's the concept of equality? Clearly I could talk for many hours on the concept of equality. We're not essentially talking about, if you like, a sort of totally equitable society, where in a sense, if you like, we're all on the same we're all in the same position in terms of social position, in terms of access to wealth, to the benefits of a contemporary democratic society. What essentially is interpreted as equality in the context of, if you like, the public agenda, is equality between groups. We're not talking about equality within groups. So the aim essentially is to even out the social position, the distribution of social positions between ethnic groups in the case that we're talking about now. And the same would go for the other aspects of the agenda. Now, essentially, we'll see as I go into a little bit more detail how the equality legislation actually emerged. It was a very lengthy process. And as I said, that would never have happened had it not been for those many years of, if you like, agitation. The legislation would never have happened without that. And we'll see, as I've said already, that neoliberalism has a deeply problematic relationship with equality. Okay. First piece of legislation outlawing discrimination was in 1965. But right back to 1951, there have been attempts by members of the Labour Party in opposition to get private members' bills to start the ball rolling in terms of legislation. Now that's only 3 years after the SS Empire Windrush arrived from the Caribbean in 1948. There were already then signs of deeply problematic experience of those migrants, in other words, suffering racism and discrimination across a whole wide range of areas. So it took from 1951 to 1965 for there to be a piece of legislation on the books, and that only covered discrimination in places of public resort. It didn't cover education, it didn't cover employment, it didn't cover housing. Why was it so weak? Essentially because the Labour government at the time had a tiny majority. And Harold Wilson, who was then Prime Minister, was extremely concerned that he couldn't carry his own party with him, not all of his own party. And therefore he thought, well, better to get a relatively weak piece of legislation on the statute book than to get none on at all. And so he went for this. Then 3 years later, it was strengthened to cover those areas that I just said it was excluded, in terms of education, employment, and so on. But very interestingly, actually, there was a speech given by the then Home Secretary, James Callaghan, early in 1968, to the Institute of Race Relations, where he appears to suggest that education isn't a problematic area. The focus of his speech was actually on employment, it was on housing, and it was about access to other things like loan finance and so on, and insurance. So in other words, the suggestion appeared to be that he didn't see education as being particularly problematic. The last, technically, of the Race Relations Acts was in 1976. The last act. And that showed that, in a sense, it was accompanied by the emergence of the Commission for Racial Equality. Now, the significance of this last act, and I haven't got time, obviously, to go into great detail about this, the significance of this final act was that there were powers to investigate organisations. And I'll just give you one illustration within the area of education. I was called in by the CRE because they said that they were going to investigate the St George's Hospital and Medical School in London, because it was suggested that the admissions process was deeply racist and sexist. It discriminated against those who were black and those who were female. So God help you if you were both. Basically, in actually looking at the data, we discovered that the computer program that was effectively choosing potential candidates had negative weightings on race and gender. Okay? No one appeared to take responsibility for this. So in other words, those applicants were actually filtered out at that stage or scaled down drastically. And I then looked at the data at the next phase for those who got through that. The next phase was the interview phase. And again, there was differential success on the basis of race and gender. Now, that had implications for the whole of tertiary education. I got a phone call from a very senior member of this university, who shall remain nameless, saying, you know, should we be worried? There was a national debate as a result of this, because it created a real furore at the time. So that was a potential powerful tool. The important thing is it wasn't strengthened, the race legislation, until 2000, until actually after the McPherson inquiry reported in 1999. Why wasn't it strengthened? Because the Tory party came into government. It stayed in government throughout that period from 1979 up to Blair's first government in 1997. Okay? All of those of us who were lobbying for change basically found completely deaf ears. I'll go into a little bit more why. So basically what the CRE had to rely on through this period that the Tories were in charge was trying to get organisations to institute non-discriminatory practices. The approach in Britain has always been very softly. It's what has been described as a liberal approach to equal opportunity. It's focused on fair practices. So, for example, in education, the employment of teaching staff, delivery of education, and so on. So, in other words, you get the processes right. The more radical vision is one where you actually start by saying, this is what we want to have, and this is what we're going to produce. And this, in US and other countries like India, has taken the form of affirmative action, where, for example, if you're not getting many black students in a particular university or a particular department, you can apply quotas and saying, we are going to have that number of black students. The British approach says, we're going to get the procedures right so that we can set a target and hope over time to achieve that. Now that is because there is very different legislation in the two countries, say between the US and here. So the focus is very different. The first puts the emphasis on means. If we get the means right, then the ends will follow. And the other version puts effectively the focus on ends. We say, this is what we're having. Okay. And so, in other words, it's a very much more powerful tool. But also, we haven't got time to talk about this, is also problematic in a number of other ways. Okay, so the sad news was therefore was that the process of change was then halted pretty rapidly after the election of the first Thatcher government in 79. Prior to that, on the basis of the 76 Act, there was a statutory duty, special duty imposed on local authorities under Section 71 to ensure that they were basically following the remit of the law to ensure that discrimination didn't take place in any of the functions that they were involved in. The best authorities, mainly the large labour-run metro authorities, formed race and gender women's units, but not all of them did. Some of them did little or nothing, and that's pre-Thatcher. Once we got to the early 80s, the Thatcher government launched sustained attacks on what it saw as being the profligacy of these large metro authorities. And there's a strange sort of, you have a sense of deja vu when you think about some of the modern Tory policies. So essentially, the idea was that they were having none of this agenda that was working towards equality. Because going back to Dennis's definition, it's about effectively intervening in markets. It's about essentially saying that this was, in a sense, the start of, if you like, of the marketisation. The first thing that Thatcher did was to impose tight fiscal constraints. Now, what that did on local authorities is for them to have to turn around and say, well, you know, given that we've got much smaller budgets, what can we concentrate? Or what do we have to concentrate on? Us are reducing resources. So they avoid, in a sense, getting rid of the frontline services for obvious reasons. And what do they get rid of? Gender and race units. And that was precisely what Thatcher had actually wanted. She'd wanted those things to disappear. Some of the big authorities didn't get rid of them entirely, but they combined them and reduced staffing and so on. But that was the first thing. Then they effectively privatised public services. I haven't got time to go into the details of that, but basically what they wanted to do was to privatise, in a sense, public works by bringing in private organisations. And crucially, they brought in the Education Reform Act, did that for education. So what did this do? This is all about the marketisation of education. There are three key developments: the setting up of city technology colleges, independent of the local government, gave schools the option of opting out of local government control, and there's a move towards open enrolments. It's parents, on the basis of parents' right to choose. So it's all about the operation of the market. So it's all about, therefore, schools being able to effectively opt out of their, in a sense, governance by the local authority. And what happens then? The authority has no power then to take forward the equality agenda. In other words, they're effectively like private companies in that respect. So that's the whole idea here, was to take away the power of local authorities to be able to do their duty in terms of equalities. So the power is now decentralized to local governing bodies. So in terms of race and gender equality, we're then actually based essentially on trusting those local governing bodies to take on those ideas. Now, sure, it depends then on who's elected. In other words, what those governing bodies actually look like and what are they committed to? Because you haven't got the local authority saying you've got to take this, that and the other on board. So the LEAs no longer have a regulatory function. And the national curriculum, in a sense, was so prescriptive that it pushed to the margins anything that had to do with training children to grow up as adults in a multicultural society. And again, that was the idea, straight instruction and getting rid of these soft subjects around the edges. Then effectively we had the emergence of the EHRC, the Equality and Human Rights Commission. So in other words, this was effectively moving away from the single equality regimes that we had before and moved to a generic agenda. So the CRE was effectively wound up at the end of September 2007. The EOC, the Equal Opportunities Commission, the Gender Commission, and the DRC Disability Rights Commission, they also closed at the same time. And they were effectively then replaced by this umbrella body that had the combined remit. Okay? Now, in some ways you could think, well, maybe this is a good move. In the sense that, for example, it's quite easy for some people to, in a sense, fall down the middle. If you go to, for example, as a black woman, if you go to the CRE, they might turn around and say, well, actually, we really think it's a gender issue, and send them off to the EOC. And they might say, well, I'm not sure about that thing. So you could make a case that this might be a better approach, but there are serious concerns as well. Because one of the things that it does effectively is risk demoting the race agenda. As soon as you remove the very direct focus, and I was involved with a lot of race activists at the time, and people concerned with or working for the CRE, and nearly everyone I spoke to was concerned about what would happen to the race agenda once it had been put as part of this generic body. Now, I think probably I ought to leave that issue of capability theory, which takes a little while to explain. So let's move to what the Equality Act actually did. It introduced 9 protected characteristics, of which race was only one. And now you see why I made the point from a few seconds ago, that now, in a sense, they're involved with a massive agenda, an absolutely massive agenda. There's one thing which I don't want to lose here, actually, which is really important. And people often forget that this is what New Labour did at the end of its time, the beginning of 2010. Basically, one of those protected characteristics related to socioeconomic status, in other words, class, effectively. Now that was a really, really important move. In the sense, what they were saying is that local authorities not only do you have a duty in relation to race, gender, sexual orientation and so on, and disability, you've also got to take into account the impact of, or potential impact of, policies and practices on those from different socioeconomic backgrounds. And that was potentially quite powerful. Unfortunately, something rather unfortunate happened in May 2010, as I'm sure you know. Within 6 months of the election, the socioeconomic duty had gone. Theresa May decided that this was all nonsense, this stuff about class. Now that could potentially have been quite powerful. I say potentially, because you've got legislation doesn't mean it works. I've been involved in a big European project now for many years with the Fundamental Rights Agency in Vienna. And I sort of sit there proudly with the United Kingdom in front of me with all the other countries of the EU represented. And whenever legislation is mentioned, they turn to me and they say, it's all right for you, Peter, in the UK. You've got it sorted. You've got all this legislation. As if somehow having the legislation means that's fine. No, it isn't, as I kept telling them. But anyway, coming back to this, that duty could have been powerful. What did the government then do? It immediately announced a review of the EHRC. It would love to see the back of it. But also it's quite politically useful, as the Thatcher government thought about the CRE. And why is it useful? Because if anybody says, well, what are you doing about equality? Oh, we've got this commission. So it's good to have it, as long as you make sure it doesn't do anything, or doesn't do anything powerful. So the first thing it did was to review it, and then it massively cut its funds. And even more insidiously, it launched the Red Tape Challenge, which some of you may have heard of. And what this effectively did was, under the guise of democracy, it actually said to people, look, we've got this new Equality Act. Is there any way we can reduce the red tape? Have you got any suggestions of what we could dispense with, what we could simplify? So you've had a huge build-up to an act, okay, that takes on board developments for decades, and the Cameron government comes along and says, well, let's see if people have got constructive ideas of effectively how to destroy it. So we didn't do it. They told us that this was no good, and we didn't need that, and we didn't need that. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work like that, because most of the people who responded were people who were backing the act and said, hands off it. In fact, they took off the website my response to it, but that's possibly not surprising. So, things have got very difficult, the whole equality agenda. And that's because it effectively undermines that whole basis of the neoliberal free market strategy. What it's saying basically is that people and organisations have an inalienable right as private, say, organisations to behave in ways that they see fit. And on that rather negative note, I'll hand back to Dennis.
Thank you. Well, I just do this. Anyone got any questions for Peter? Well, or
I
wanted
to ask who the person was that you said, I wrote it down, that said it wasn't necessary for the Race Relations Act to extend to education. Who was that?
That was James Callaghan. He was a future Prime Minister. He was the Prime Minister when he lost to Thatcher in 1979, but this is in an earlier phase of his career as Home Secretary. It's a very long speech, very interesting speech. And I was hoping that we'd have it here.
In fact, yes, we have. The speech is somewhere out there, the notes of the speech.
Okay.
You can have a look at that. It was given to the TUC, I think Medusa knows where it is.
It's really quite interesting that he specifically said, we don't think there's a problem with education, effectively. That's summing up about half, three-quarters of a page of argument. But he's basically saying, well, we don't really need to worry about that, but we do need to worry about employment and housing and so on. And people's access to housing through getting loan finance and so on. You know, they were problematic areas, but education certainly hadn't been sought at.
Right, okay, I'm interested in social mobility, and I'm interested in education and employment as key aspects of social mobility. And education is important because without it, you can't really increase your life chances. You're all here because you had good qualifications, which you will exchange for degrees, which you will then exchange again for economic capital, and that's how you're going to get social mobility and improve your life chances. And what I'm looking at is this idea of the kind of reduction of the importance of racial equality, particularly as Peter's just said, with the 2010 Equality Act. The idea of 9 protected characteristics where race has no more significance than, say, marriage or pregnancy. This is particularly problematic. Now, I'll just lay my cards on the table. In terms of this idea of a post-race society, the only post I'm interested in is what's coming through my door. I'm not buying this idea of post man or post woman, unless they've got male for me. Because what we're seeing here is transformation of the same types of inequalities. And what is always constant is things remain the same, but there's ideas of reform which appears to change things where nothing really changes. Now, in terms of the education of black children, what we had in the 1960s was a new phenomenon. We had, for the first time, the children of West Indian immigrants that was born in this country, myself included, yes, I am one of them, which is why I have a particular interest here, going into the education system. Now, this was treated as an emergency situation because there was no precedence for this. The amount of black children that were entering the education system en masse. And the idea behind this was, how do we deal with them? And as Peter said, you know, there's always been ideas that we look to America in terms of how do we solve the race problem. And there were ideas that, look, you know, somehow these children were different. And the idea of solving the problem was to assimilate them. Assimilate them into the majority culture. This idea of a flattening process. Because within that is the idea that culture is the problem. So we need to kind of strip them of their culture, make them into what Troina calls trainee whites, and problem is solved. So you had various policies which were aimed at assimilation. Now, the thing is this, you had government directly involved in all of this, because, you know, we had, from 1948, we've got this idea of a welfare state, and we've got the idea that the state and state policies are there to act as a kind of mediator, a kind of referee for social equality. So it's about getting these children through the education system, but there's this idea that how do we cope with them because they have got particular needs. Now, one of the main things that they identified was a problem was the language of black children. And there are documents out there which you've got teachers in schools in the West Midlands, in Birmingham, talking about this idea about, you know, how do we assimilate them, you know, language is a problem, talking about the idea of parental support, they haven't got parental support, the culture, the way they live, the idea of blackness being somehow pathological and in opposition to whiteness. And within all this, you have got like different policies that started to emerge. One of them was actually the busing policy. The busing policy was dispersing black children, because there was the idea that if too many black children were in schools, then it's going to have a negative effect on the education of white children. What I refer to as cultural contagion. You know, this idea of this fiscal contagion, it's this cultural contagion. And governments, they didn't implement these policies, but they allowed local education authorities to implement these policies if they saw a need. So what we had was Bradford local education authority implemented the policy of dispersing. And when we're talking about dispersing of immigrant children, we're talking about the children of immigrants that were born here, Caribbean children, Asian children. We had Southall in London, who actually took up this policy as well. And we had West Bromwich, which is now Sandwell. Now, Peter has written extensively about the problems that we have had in Smethwick over the years. We can talk about Enoch Powell and the Rivers of Blood speech and, you know, all of these going on around the same time, 1968, in the Britannia Hotel in Birmingham. And out there, there are documents from Beaches Road School, which actually talks about the problem of dispersing and whether they should do it or not. Schools like Westminster Road School in Handsworth, they had, I think it was 70% of Asian children, Asian and black children in school, and the Birmingham Planet, which was the local paper at the time, it's now the Evening Mail, was saying that if you listen to government policy, that school was ripe for dispersal. So assimilation was this idea of, it's supposed to be benign, moving black children out, bustling them out to make sure that they can integrate into wider society. Now, I have said that these ideas are kind of endogenous in terms of one starts within the stage of another. So you've got like the preceding stage starting in one and then moving through to another. Now, by the late 1960s, and this was after, as Peter just said, the 1968 Race Relations Act, there, and after the Plowden Report in 1967, there were ideas that assimilation wasn't working. So the government took another approach, but what was happening here was that you had a lot of black children during assimilation was actually, I should have told you this, were actually sent to schools for the educational subnormal for no other reason than they were perceived to have a different language. I interviewed not too long ago a man in his 50s who came to England when he was 10, and it was a cultural shock to him. You know, it was a new environment, new school, totally different way of life, and he had trouble fitting in. He didn't really talk to a lot of people in the school, and he actually had a fight because a ball hit him and some kids picked on him and he fought back. And the teachers went around to his parents' house and said the best thing for him would be to go to this ESN school. They could support his needs appropriately. Now, a lot of black children were sent to these schools because there was this idea that somehow they were culturally backward. And whilst they were in these schools, they didn't get the chance to study for proper educational qualifications. The idea was controlling them. They played a lot of sports, they did art or whatever, but they didn't get a proper education. So what you had then was a generation of children sent to these schools for the educational subnormal for no reason at all, just because there were ideas about they were pathologically different because of their culture, and they were denied qualifications, didn't get the opportunity to sit where you are all sitting, and as a result, it restricted their life chances and opportunities. The person I spoke to is in his 50s, and he's got absolutely no educational qualifications whatsoever as a result of being sent to these schools. The point I'm making is this. Even though you've got the 1968 equality, the Race Relations Act 1968, and you've got this idea of equality, black children are still being denied their rights to education. Effectively, symbolic violence. They're not going through the education system in the same way as other children for no reason other than the wider society's perception of them and referrals from teachers. Okay, so what you had was, by the 1960s, you've got a kind of change in policy approaches from assimilation to multicultural education. Now, there are ideas that assimilation strategies weren't working, so we've got to think about something else. So multicultural education became a kind of theme for the day, whereas culture and ideas of assimilating or integrating by promoting the different cultures of black kids became the dominant theme. Now, that idea, what it did was it kind of internalized racism, because it did not address the problems of racism in wider society. What it actually did was say that, you know, there's this idea that teachers and people and educationalists thought that by promoting culture and making white children and other children aware of the different cultures of different groups, then tolerance would be a way of actually solving the problems of black kids in the education sector. Now, Peter's talked about this idea of local education authorities. Now, under the 1944 Education Act, there was this idea that local education authorities had what we call relative autonomy. They could, to some degree, dictate how children were taught and actually devolve powers down to teachers in terms of how teachers were teaching them. So you had some local education authorities where there were quite a number of immigrant children adopting multicultural education strategies because they thought it was the best thing to do at the time. But you've also got a lot of things going on around the time that this is going on, multicultural education, because Britain is going into a recession. And this is the kind of first stages of the kind of neoliberal approach where the state supposedly steps back and starts to bring in the private sector. In 1976, Harold Wilson, one of the last things he'd done before he kind of removed himself from the Labour Party and his being Prime Minister, was he took a massive loan off the International Monetary Foundation. What fun. One of the things that they, that the conditions was that he had to reduce public spending. That allowed the private sector to start coming into society in a big way from 1976. You also had James Callan, who became Prime Minister after Harold Wilson, actually saying that the recession is the blame of education. Because education is not teaching people the skills needed for the economy, rather there's this idea that about equalization and equality and all that it might be you know, ideal in the proper world where the economy doesn't matter, but education started to become the kind of scapegoat for what was going on. But at the same time, what we had was increasingly more African-American children were failing to take O-level and CSE examinations. The exclusion processes that started with assimilation were still going through in multicultural education as well. So you still had this high rate of exclusion of black children who weren't getting the qualifications, therefore they were consigned to the bottom tiers of the labour market. In fact, in Birmingham, between 1974 and 1980, a research was carried out by the Commission of Racial Equality, which was, I think, published in 1980. And what they found was that black Caribbean boys were four times more likely to be excluded than their white counterparts, despite all these ideas of multicultural education and so forth. You still had a lot of black kids being excluded. Now, as I've said, you've got to think about the social context of the situation. We've got the 1976 Race Relations Act, and we've got like anti-racist education. Now, anti-racist education was kind of run alongside multicultural education, but some authorities decided to take it up because they argued that ideas of just ignoring racism in wider society wasn't doing anyone any good. You had to tackle ideas of racism. Melissa has got a lot of information out there about anti-racist strategies that teachers took up in schools at that time. Now, a lot of the money for anti-racist education and also multicultural education came from Section 11 funding, which was of the Government Act 1966. So what you have here is Britain going through a recession. You have got a new kind of phenomenon in the education system. There's ideas that they need special educational support. You have a lot of money in the education system being spent on the needs of minority groups. And you have got the political changes going on, the decline of industry, the rise of the service sector, and there's ideas that people aren't being equipped with the skills needed for the labour market, and at the same time you've got a lot of money being spent on the education of black children. 2.5 million was claimed between 1975 and 1978 from various local education authorities and district councils. So you can imagine This is going up into the Thatcher government, how you've got a lot of concern about money being spent on education for black kids and they're still not attaining, and you know, we've got a problem here. The money needs to be diverted somehow. So what you had then from 1979 onwards, when Maggie Thatcher came into power, you had a lot of opinion moulding, where the Thatcher regime used the media to kind of shape public opinion against the idea of racial equality. You know, we've got to forget about this, we've got to think about the economy. And she used the media, particularly the Mirror and the Sun, to push through ideas of why this type of education was bad. And you had ideas of the loony left, people like Bernie Grant, who was in charge of Haringey Council. These were people who were active proponents of anti-racism education. They were branded Marxists, leftists. Jeremy Corbyn has never recovered from it. He was one of them as well, which is why we've got, you know, the media still has this problem. Don't let him in. He is one of them. And the new right started to take up this idea that schools were being taken over by left-wing radicals. Something needed to be done about it. And more than that, there was this idea that the standards of education was declining, because the decentralization of education, which allowed local education authorities to practically teach whatever they want, whatever they thought was best, was actually declining the standards in schools at the same time. So you had a groundswell of public opinion against the education system, particularly from black community organizations. And that led to the first report into the education of black children, because there was a lot of black children still being expelled from schools. Now, Lord Rampton started the first report. His report in 1981 found that there were problems with the education system. And he used the term in 1981, institutional racism, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Particularly after the Macpherson inquiry. His report also reinforced ideas that black culture was pathological, parents not supporting their children, all these ideas as well. But he actually resigned from the commission because he felt that he was being pushed into a corner by the Thatcher government, who wanted him to kind of just, you know, really say that, you know, there's no problem there. And Lord Swan took over, and his report in 1985 also, to a great extent, supported what Rampton's report recommended. And he also recommended the idea of political education. One of the things he recommended was RAT, racial awareness training, and to get more black teachers in the education system. All of this was totally ignored by the Thatcher government. And in 1988, the Conservative pushed through the 19 Education Reform Act, and that was the restoration of educational principles. Now, the key thing about this is, this was probably the greatest state intervention in education since 1880. When the government stepped in and had formal education for people who were between 5 and 13. They stepped in to kind of give schools now this idea of a national curriculum, assessment and attainment targets from 7, 11, 14 and 16. In other words, they turned the education sector into a market and reduced the power of local education authorities, getting rid of all of this idea of multicultural education, anti-racist education, and so forth. Open enrollment, giving more power to governors and to parental bodies. But you've got to remember as well, there are more powers being devolved to parents, but only the kind of middle class parents who've got more symbolic capital. working class parents, which the majority of African Caribbean parents were working class, had less capital, so they couldn't get involved in open enrollment. And there's also this idea that education authority, schools can opt out of local education authority control. So what you've got there is this paradox where you've got government both saying this is laissez-faire, it's non-state intervention, but it's the greatest form of intervention because what they're doing is they're stepping in to take power from local education authorities who would know the education system in each area much better than governments, this idea of more social control. So, consequences for the equality agenda that arose from the 1988 Education Reform Act. Well, you've got a shift from ideas of equality and equity, and you've moved now to ideas of formal instruction. There's more of an emphasis on competition within the education sector and less of this idea of schools being used as places of equalization and more for instruction. No concern given to racial disadvantage in the education sector. So for the next 18 years of Conservative government, what you had was policies after policies which brought in the idea of colorblind legislation. One of the things that John Major said that you are only going to upset the white majority if you disadvantage them by bringing in policies which claim to giving non-white people more rights. So their policies were more across the board and actually ignored the persisting disadvantage of black kids in the education system. Now, in 1997, you had Tony Blair and New Labour coming in with ideas of the third way. Now, basically, it's halfway between the private and public sector reforms that was happening with the 1988 Education Act, and also bringing in ideas of the state as well. So it's halfway between the state and the public sector. And there were further reduction of LEA powers under this 2002 Education Act, and also the creation of academies. Now, academies were initially schools that were created in areas where you had high levels of deprivation. They're actually schools that were failing, which had to merge, and the government pumped a lot of money into them. But they slowly changed, which is something I'll talk about in a bit. And after 2003, you had a statutory duty imposed on educational institutions to collate ethnicity data, which was part of the recommendations of the McPherson report. But you didn't have any real lead from government in terms of what to do with the data. That has always been the case. The data is just collected. And you know, a lot of the time, you have like educational institutions saying, yes, we're collecting the data, we're spreading diversity, we've got Black History Month, you can get like curry goat and chicken in the canteen, things like that. But there's nothing really done about exclusion and inequality, and the government takes no lead whatsoever. What is also crucial as well, under the 2006 Education Act, you had academies exempt from the financial penalties which were applied to NEAs for expelling pupils. When local education authorities expelled pupils, they got fined, not academies. They were exempt from that. That means they could just expel as many kids as they want. And you've got to remember, we're going from the 1960s, we're on like in the 2000s, and you've still got high rates of black exclusion. And now it's almost done through legislation as well, because there's nothing to stop them being excluded. So you've got different acts. I think we've got the 1996 Education Act, and you've also got different powers where when children are expelled, this is when local education authorities get involved, because then they get thrown out of academies and local education authorities have to find somewhere for them to go. And most of these are black children. So, some of the things that Labour did, it wasn't all bad, I suppose, under the Third Way Education Action Zones, which encouraged partnerships between businesses and schools. More and more, this is the idea of the market and the idea of neoliberalism coming into the education sector from the international, the IMF fund in